adds, something that looked like a medieval torture device but was really a nail header and a froe for splitting shingles. Between them, Jamie and Ian had succeeded in getting a roof on the cabin before snow fell, but the sheds were less important. A block of wood sat constantly by the fire, the froe struck through it, ready for anyone with an idle moment to strike off a few more shingles. That corner of the hearth was in fact devoted to wood carving. Ian had made a rough but serviceable stool, which sat under one of the windows for good light, and the shavings could all be tossed thriftily into the fire, which burned day and night. Myers had bought a few women's tools for me as well, a huge sewing basket well supplied with needles, pins, scissors, and balls of thread and lengths of linen, muslin, and woven wool. While sewing wasn't my favourite occupation, I was nonetheless delighted to see these, since owing to Jamie and Ian's constantly lurching through thickets and crawling about on the roofs, the knees, elbows, and shoulders of all their garments were in constant disrepair.
"Another one."
Jamie sat bolt upright in bed beside me. "Another what?" I asked sleepily, opening one eye. It was very dark in the cabin. The fire burnt to coals on the hearth.
"Another bloody leak. It hit me in the ear, damn it."
He sprang out of bed, went to the fire, and thrust in a stick of wood. Once it was alight, he brought it back and stood on the bedstead, thrusting his torch upward as he glowered at the roof in search of the fiendish leak.
"Mmm."
Ian, who slept on a low trundle bed, rolled over and groaned inquiringly. Rollo, who insisted on sharing it with him, emitted a brief woof, relapsed into a heap of grey fur, and resumed his loud snoring. "A leak," I told Ian, keeping a narrow eye on Jamie's torch. I wasn't having my precious feather bed set alight by stray sparks.
"Oh."
Ian lay with an arm across his face.
"Has it snowed again?"
"It must have." The windows were covered with squares of oiled deer hide, tacked down, and there was no sound from outside, but the air had the peculiar, muffled quality that came with snow. Snow came silently and mounded on the roof, then, beginning to melt from the warmth of the shingles underneath, would drip down the slope of the roof to leave a gleaming portcullis of icicles along the eaves. Now and then, though, the roaming water found a split in a shingle, or a join where the overlapping edges had warped, and drips poked their icy fingers through the roof. Jamie regarded all such intrusions as a personal affront, and brooked no delay in dealing with them.
"Look," he exclaimed. "There it is. See it?"
I shifted my glassy gaze from the hairy ankles in front of my nose to the roof overhead. Sure enough, the torchlight revealed the black line of a split in one shingle, with a spreading dark patch of dampness on the underside. As I watched, a clear drop formed, glistening red in the torchlight, and fell, with a plop, onto the pillow beside me.
"We could shift the bed a bit," I suggested,
though with no particular hope. I had been through this before. All suggestions that repair work could wait till daylight were met with astonished refusal. No proper man, I was given to understand, would countenance such a thing. Jamie stepped down, off the bedstead, and prodded Ian in the ribs with his foot.
"Get up and knock at the spot where the split is, Ian. I'll deal with it on the outside."
Seizing a fresh shingle, a hammer, a hatchet, and a bag of nails, he headed for the door.
"Don't you go up on the roof in that," I exclaimed, sitting up abruptly. "That's your good woolen shirt."
He halted by the door, glared briefly at me, then, with the rebuking expression of an early Christian martyr, laid down his tools, stripped off the shirt, dropped it on the floor, picked up the tools, and strode majestically out to deal with the leak, buttocks clenched with determined zeal. I rubbed a hand over my sleep-puffed face and moaned softly to myself.
"He'll be all right, Auntie,"
Ian assured me. He yawned widely, not bothering to cover his mouth, and reluctantly rolled out of his own warm bed. Thumps on the roof that were definitely not the feet of 8 tiny reindeer announced that Jamie was in place.
I rolled out of the way and got up, resigned, as Ian mounted the bedstead and jabbed a stick of firewood upward into the damp patch, jarring the shingles enough for Jamie to locate the leak on the outside. A short period of rending and banging followed, as the defective shingle was yanked loose and replaced, and the leak was summarily extinguished, leaving no more evidence of its existence than the small heap of snow that had fallen in through the hole left by the removed shingle. Back in bed, Jamie curled his freezing body around me, clasped me to his icy bosom, and fell promptly asleep, full of the righteous satisfaction of a man who has defended hearth and home against all threat. It was a fragile and tenuous foothold that we had upon the mountain, but a foothold, for all that. We hadn't much meat. There'd been little time for hunting beyond squirrel and rabbit, and those useful rodents had gone to their winter rest by now. But a fair amount of dried vegetables, from yams to squash to wild onions and garlic, plus a bushel or two of nuts, and the small stock of herbs I had managed to gather and dry. It made for a sparse diet, but with careful management, we could survive till spring. With few chores to do outside, there was time to talk, to tell stories, and to dream. Between the useful objects like spoons and bowls, Jamie took time to carve the pieces of a wooden chess set, and spent a good deal of his time trying to inveigle me or Ian into playing with him. Ian and Rollo, who both suffered badly from cabin fever, took to visiting Anna Uka frequently, sometimes going on extended hunting trips with young men from the village, who were pleased to have the benefit of his and Rollo's company.
"The lad speaks the Indian tongue a great deal better than he does Greek or Latin," Jamie observed with some dourness, watching Ian exchanging cordial insults with an Indian companion as they left on one such excursion.
"Well, if Marcus Aurelius had written about tracking porcupines, I expect he'd have found a more eager audience," I replied soothingly. Dearly as I loved Ian, I was myself not displeased by his frequent absence. There were definitely times when three was a crowd. "There is nothing more delightful in life than a feather bed and an open fire, except a feather bed with a warm and tender lover in it. When Ian was gone, we wouldn't trouble with rushlights, but would go to bed with the dark, and lie curled together in shared warmth, talking late into the night, laughing and telling stories, sharing our pasts, planning our future, and somewhere, in the midst of the talking, pausing to enjoy the wordless pleasures of the present."
"Tell me about Brianna."
These were Jamie's favourite stories, the tales of Brianna as a child. What she had said and worn and done, how she had looked, all her accomplishments and her tastes. "Did I tell you about the time I was invited to her school to talk about being a doctor?"
"No."
He shifted to make himself more comfortable, rolling onto his side and fitting himself to my shape behind.
"Why should you do that?"
"It was what they called career day. The school teachers invited a lot of people with different jobs to come and explain what they did, so the children would have some idea of what a lawyer does, for instance, or a firefighter."
"I should think that one would be fairly obvious."
"Hush! Or a veterinarian. That's a doctor who treats animals. Or a dentist. That's a special doctor who deals only with teeth."
"With teeth? What can you do to a tooth besides pull it?"
"You'd be surprised." I brushed the hair out of my face and up off my neck. "Anyway, they'd always ask me to come, because it wasn't at all common for a woman to be a doctor then."
"You think it's common now?"
He laughed, and I kicked him lightly in the shin. "Well, it got more common rather soon after that, but at the time it wasn't. And when I'd finished speaking and asked if there were any questions, an obnoxious little boy piped up and said that his mother said women who worked were no better than prostitutes, and they ought to be home minding their families instead of taking jobs away from men."
"I shouldn't think his mother can have met many prostitutes."
"No, I don't imagine. Nor all that many women with jobs either. But when he said that, Brianna stood up and said in a very loud voice, "Well, you'd better be glad my mama's a doctor, because you're going to need one." Then she hit him on the head with her arithmetic book, and when he lost his balance and fell down, she jumped on his stomach and punched him in the mouth. I could feel his chest and stomach quivering against my back.
"Oh, braw lassie. Did the schoolmaster not tawse her for it, though?"
"They don't beat children in school. She had to write a letter of apology to the little beast, but then he had to write one to me, and she thought that was a fair exchange. The more embarrassing part was that it turned out his father was a doctor too, one of my colleagues at the hospital."
"I wouldn't have supposed you'd taken a job he'd wanted."
"How did you guess?" His breath was warm and ticklish on the back of my neck. I reached back and stroked the length of a long, hairy thigh, enjoying the hollow and swell of the muscle.
"You said she was at a university and studying history, like Frank Randall. Did she never want to be a doctor, like you?"
A large hand cupped my bottom and began to knead it gently.
"Oh, she did when she was little. I used to take her to the hospital now and then, and she was fascinated by all the equipment. She loved to play with my stethoscope and the otoscope, a thing you look in ears with. But then she changed her mind. She changed it a dozen times, at least. Most children do."
"They do?"
This was a novel thought to him. Most children of the time would simply adopt the profession of their parents, or perhaps be apprenticed to learn one chosen for them.
"Oh, yes. Let me see. She wanted to be a ballerina for a while, like most little girls." "That's a dancer who dances on her toes," I explained. And he laughed in surprise. "Then she wanted to be a garbage man. That was after our garbage man gave her a ride in his truck. And then a deep-sea diver and a mailman and..."
"What in God's name is a deep-sea diver, let alone a garbage man?"
By the time I had finished a brief catalogue of 20th-century occupations, we were facing each other, our legs twined comfortably together, and I was admiring the way his nipple stiffened to a tiny bump under the ball of my thumb. I never was sure whether she really wanted to read history, or whether she did it mostly to please Frank. She loved him so much, and he was so proud of her. I paused, thinking, as his hand played down the length of my back. She started taking history classes at the university when she was still in high school. I told you how the school system works. And then, when Frank died, I rather think she went ahead with history because she thought he would have wanted it.
That's loyal.
Yes. I ran my hand up through his hair, feeling the solid, rounded bones of his skull and his scalp under my fingers. Can't think where she got that particular trait from. He snorted briefly and gathered me closer.
Can't you?
Without waiting for an answer, he went on.
If she goes on with history, do you think she'll find us? Written down somewhere, I mean.
The thought had honestly not occurred to me, and for a moment I lay quite still. Then I stretched a bit and laid my head on his shoulder with a small laugh, not altogether humorous.
I shouldn't think so.
Not unless we were to do something newsworthy. I gestured vaguely toward the cabin wall and the endless wilderness outside. Not much chance of that here, I don't imagine, and she'd have to be deliberately looking in any case.
Would she?
I was silent for a moment, breathing the musky, deep scent of him. I hope not, I said quietly at last. She should have her own life, not spend her time looking back. He didn't respond directly to this, but took my hand and eased it between us, sighing as I took hold of him.
You're a very intelligent woman, Sassenach. But short-sighted, forby. Though perhaps it's only modesty.
And what makes you say that? I asked, mildly piqued.
The lass is loyal, you said. She'll have loved her father enough to shape her life to do as he would have wanted, even after he's dead. Do you think she loved you less?
I turn my head and let the piled hair fall down over my face.
No,
I said at last, voice muffled in the pillow.
Well, then.
He took me by the hips and turned me, rolling slowly on top of me. We didn't speak any more then, as the melting boundaries of our bodies disappeared. It was slow, dreamy, and peaceful. His body mine, as much as mine was his, so that I curled my foot round his leg and felt both smooth sole and hairy shin, felt calloused palm and tender flesh. Was knife and sheath together, the rhythm of our movement that of one heart beating. The fire crackled softly to itself, casting red and yellow highlights on the wooden walls of our snug refuge, and we lay in quiet peace, not bothering to sort out whose limbs were whose. On the very verge of sleep, I felt Jamie's breath warm on my neck.
"She'll look," he said. With certainty.
There was a brief thaw 2 days later, and Jamie, suffering slightly from cabin fever himself, decided to take advantage of it to go hunting. There was still snow on the ground, but it was thin and patchy. The going would be easy enough on the slopes, he thought. I wasn't so sure as I scooped snow into a basket for melting later in the morning. The snow under the bushes still lay thick, though it had indeed melted on the exposed ground. I hoped he was right, though. Our food supplies were low, and we had had no meat at all for more than a week. Even the snares Jamie kept set had been buried under the snow. I took my snow inside and tipped it into the large cauldron, feeling, as I always did, rather like a witch.
"Double, double, toil and trouble,"
I muttered, watching the white clumps hiss and fade into the roiling liquid. I had one large cauldron filled with water, which bubbled constantly on the fire. This wasn't only the basic supply for washing, but the means of cooking everything that couldn't be grilled, fried or roasted. Stews and things to be boiled were put into hollow gourds or stoneware jars, sealed and lowered on strings into the bubbling depths, to be hauled out at intervals for checking. By this means I could cook an entire meal in one pot and have hot water for washing afterward. I dumped a second basket of snow into a wooden bowl and left it to melt more slowly, drinking water for the day. Then, with nothing of great urgency to do, I sat down to read Daniel Rawlings' casebook and Men's Stockings, my toes comfortably toasting by the fire. At first, I didn't worry when Jamie didn't come back. That is, I did worry. I always worried when he was gone for long. But in a small and secret way that I succeeded for the most part in hiding from myself. When the shadows on the snow turned violet with the sinking sun, though, I began to listen for him with an increasing intensity. I went about my work in constant expectation of the crunch of his footsteps, listening for a shout, ready to run out and lend a hand if he had brought back a turkey for plucking, or some more or less edible thing in need of cleaning. I fed and watered the mules and horses, looking always up the mountain. As the afternoon light died around me, though, the expectation faded into hope. It was growing chilly in the cabin, and I went out for more wood. It couldn't be much past 4 o'clock, I thought, and yet the shadows under the huckleberry bushes were already cold and blue. Another hour, and it would be dusk. It would be full dark in 2. The woodpile was dusted with snow, the outer logs damp. By pulling a chunk of hickory from the side, though, I could reach inside and extract dry splits, being always mindful of snakes, skunks, and anything else that might have sought shelter in the hollow thus provided. I sniffed, then bent and peered cautiously inside, and as a final precaution poked a long stick inside and stirred it briefly round. Hearing no scuffles, slitherings, or other sounds of alarm, I reached inside with confidence and groped until my fingers encountered the deep-ridged grain of a chunk of fat pine. I wanted a hot, quick-burning fire tonight. After a full day spent hunting in the snow, Jamie would be chilled through. Fat pine for the heart of the fire, then,
and three small chunks of slower-burning hickory from the wet outer layer of the woodpile. I could stack those inside the hearth to dry while I finished the supper-making. Then, when we went to bed, I'd smore the fire with the damp hickory, which would burn more slowly, smouldering till morning. The shadows went to indigo and faded into the grey winter dusk. The sky was lavender with thick cloud. Snow clouds. I could breathe the cold wetness in the air. When the temperature fell after dark, so would the snow. "Bloody man," I said aloud. "What have you done, shot a moose?" My voice sounded small in the muffled air, but the thought made me feel better. If he had, in fact, bagged something large near the end of the day, he might well have chosen to camp by the carcass. Butchering a large animal was exhausting, lengthy work, and meat was too hard to come by to leave it to the mercies of predators. My vegetable stew was bubbling, and the cabin was filled with the savoury scent of onions and wild garlic, but I had no appetite. I pushed the kettle on its hook to the back of the hearth. Easy enough to heat again when he came. A tiny flash of green caught my eye, and I stooped to look. A tiny salamander, frightened out of its winter refuge in a crack of the wood. It was green and black, vivid as a tiny jewel. I scooped him up before he could panic and run into the fire, and carried the damp little thing outside, wriggling madly against my palm. I put him back in the woodpile, safely near the bottom. "Watch out," I said to him. "You might not be so lucky next time." I paused before going back inside. It had gone dark now, but I could still make out the trunks of the trees around the clearing, chalk and grey against the looming black bulk of the mountain beyond. Nothing stirred among the trees, but a few fat, wet flakes of snow began to fall from the soft pink sky, melting at once on the bare ground of the dooryard. I barred the door, ate some supper without tasting it, smoored the fire with damp hickory, and lay down to sleep. He might have met some men from Anauka and be camped with them. The scent of hickory smoke floated in the air, wisps of white curling up over the hearth. The beams above were already black with soot, though fires had burned here for no more than 2 months now. Fresh resin still oozed from the timber by my head, in small gold droplets that glowed like honey and smelled of turpentine, sharp and clean. The axe strokes in the wood showed in the firelight, and I had a sudden vivid memory of Jamie's broad back, sheened with sweat as he swung the axe over and over in strokes like clockwork, the axe blade coming down in a flash of metal inches from his foot as he worked his way along the squared rough timber. It was awfully easy to misjudge the stroke of an axe or hatchet. He might have cut wood for his fire and missed his stroke, caught an arm or leg. My imagination, always eager to help out, promptly supplied a crystal-clear vision of arterial blood spurting onto white snow in a crimson spray. I flounced over onto my side. He knew how to live outdoors. He'd spent 7 years in a cave, for heaven's sake. In Scotland, said my imagination cynically, where the biggest carnivore is a wildcat the size of a house cat, where the biggest human threat was English soldiers. "Fiddlesticks," I said, and rolled onto my back. He's a grown man, and he's armed to the teeth, and he certainly knows what to do if it's snowing. What would he do, I wondered. Find or make shelter, I supposed. I recalled the crude lean-to he'd built for us when we first camped on the ridge, and felt a little reassured. If he hadn't hurt himself, he probably wouldn't freeze to death. If he hadn't hurt himself. If something else hadn't hurt him. The bears were presumably fat and fast asleep, but the wolves still hunted in winter, and the catamounts. I recalled the one I'd met by the stream, and shivered in spite of the feather bed. I rolled onto my stomach, the quilts drawn up around my shoulders. It was warm in the cabin, warmer in the bed, but my hands and feet were still icy. I longed for Jamie in a visceral way that had nothing to do with thought or reason. To be alone with Jamie was bliss, adventure, and absorption. To be alone without him was to be alone. I could hear the whisper of snow against the oiled hide near my bed. If it kept up, his tracks would be covered by morning. And if anything had happened to him... I flung back the quilts and got up. I dressed quickly, without thinking too much about what I was doing. I'd thought too much already. I put on my woolen sark for insulation beneath my buckskins, and two pairs of stockings. I thanked God that my boots were freshly greased with otter fat. They smelt very fishy, but would keep the damp out for a good while. He had taken the hatchet. I had to split another piece of fat pine with a mallet and wedge, cursing my slowness as I did so. Having now decided on action, every small delay seemed an unbearable irritation. The long-grained wood split easily, though. I had five decent faggots, four of which I bound with a leather strap. I thrust the end of the fifth deep into the smoky embers of the fire and waited till the end was well caught. Then I tied a small medicine bag about my waist, checked to be sure I had the pouch of flints and kindling, put on my cloak, took up my bundle and my torch, and set out into the falling snow. It wasn't as cold as I had feared. Once I began moving, I was quite warm inside my wrappings. It was very quiet. There was no wind, and the whisper of the snowfall drowned all the usual noises of the night. He had meant to walk his trapline, that much I knew. If he came across promising sign en route, though, he would have followed it. The previous snow lay thin and patchy on the ground, but the earth was soaked, and Jamie was a big man. I was fairly sure I could follow his track if I came across it. And if I came across him, denned up for the night near his kill, so much the better. Two slept much better than one in the cold. Past the bare chestnuts that ringed our clearing to the west, I turned uphill. I had no great sense of direction, but could certainly tell up from down. Jamie had also carefully taught me to navigate using large immutable landmarks. I glanced toward the falls, their white cascade no more than a blur in the distance. I couldn't hear them. What wind there was must be away from me.
"When you're hunting, you want the wind toward you," Jamie had explained, "so the stag or the hare will not scent you."
I wondered uncomfortably what might be out in the dark, scenting me on the snowborne air. I wasn't armed, save for my torch. The light glittered red on the crust of packed snow and shattered from the ice that coated every twig. If I got within a quarter mile of him, he'd see me. The first snare was set in a small dell, no more than 200 yards uphill from the cabin, amid a grove of spruce and hemlock. I had been with him when he set it, but that had been in daylight. Even with the torch, everything looked strange and unfamiliar by night. I cast to and fro, bending close to bring my light near the ground. It took several journeys back and forth across the little dell before I finally spotted what I was looking for, the dark indentation of a foot in a patch of snow between two spruce trees. A little more looking, and I found the snare, still set. Either it had caught nothing, or he had removed the catch and reset it. The footprints led out of the clearing and upward again, then disappeared in a bare patch of matted dead leaves. A moment's panic as I crisscrossed the patch, looking for a scuffed place that might be a footprint. Nothing showed. The leaves must be a foot thick here, spongy and resilient. But there... yes, there was a log overturned. I could see the dark, wet furrow where it had lain, and the scuffed moss on its side. Ian had told me that squirrels and chipmunks sometimes hibernated in the cavities under logs. Very slowly, constantly losing the trail and having to circle and backtrack to find it again, I followed him from one snare to another. The snow was falling thicker and faster, and I felt some uneasiness. If it covered his tracks before I found him, how would I find my way back to the cabin? I looked back, but could see nothing behind me but a long, treacherous slope of unbroken snow that fell to the dark line of an unfamiliar brook below, its rocks poking up like teeth. No sign of the cheerful plume of smoke and sparks from our chimney. I turned slowly round in a circle, but I could no longer see the falls either.
Fine, I muttered to myself. You're lost. Now what?
I sternly quelled an incipient attack of panic and stood still to think. I wasn't totally lost. I didn't know where I was, but that wasn't quite the same thing. I still had Jamie's trail to guide me, or would have until the snow covered it. And if I could find him, he presumably could find the cabin. My torch was burning dangerously low. I could feel the heat of it blistering on my hand. I extracted another one of the dry faggots from under my cloak and lit it from the stub of the first, dropping the ember just before it burned my fingers. Was I going farther from the cabin, I wondered, or walking parallel to it? I knew that the trap line described a rough circle, but had no idea precisely how many snares there were. I had found three so far, all empty and waiting. The fourth one wasn't empty. My torch caught the glitter of ice crystals, fringing the fur of a large hare stretched out under a frozen bush. I touched it, picked it up, and disentangled the noose from its neck. It was stiff, whether from cold or rigor mortis. Been dead a while, then. And what did that tell me about Jamie's whereabouts? I tried to think logically, ignoring the increasing cold seeping through my boots and the growing numbness of face and fingers. The hare lay in the snow. I could see the indentations of its paw prints and the flurry of its death struggle. I couldn't see any of Jamie's footprints, though. All right. He hadn't visited this snare, then. I stood still, my breath forming small white clouds around my head. I could feel ice forming inside my nostrils. It was getting colder. Somewhere between the last snare and this one, he had left his path, then. And where had he gone? Urgently, I backtracked, looking for the last footprint I was sure of. It took a long time to find. The snow had nearly covered all the bare ground with a thin dusting of glitter. My second torch was half burned through before I found it again. There it was, a featureless blur on the mud on the edge of a stream. I had found the snare with the rabbit only by going in the direction I thought this footprint pointed, but evidently it didn't. He had stepped out of the mud and gone... where? Jamie! I shouted. I called several times, but the snow seemed to swallow my voice. I listened, but heard nothing save the gurgle of the ice-rimmed water by my feet. He wasn't behind me. He wasn't in front of me. Left, then. Or right. Eeny, meeny, miny, moe, I muttered, and turned downhill because the walking was easier, shouting now and then. I stopped to listen. Was there an answering shout? I called again, but couldn't make out a reply. The wind was coming up, rattling the tree limbs overhead. I took another step, landed on an icy rock, and my foot slid out from under me. I slipped and skidded, floundering down a short, muddy slope, hit a screen of dog hobble, burst through, and clutched a handful of icy twigs, heart pounding. At my feet was the edge of a rocky outcrop, ending in thin air. Clinging to the bush to keep from slipping, I edged my way closer and looked over. It wasn't a cliff, as I'd thought. The drop was no more than 5 feet. It wasn't this that made my heart leap into my throat, though, but rather the sight that met my eyes in the leaf-filled hollow below. There was a flurry of tossed and scuffled leaves, reminding me unpleasantly of the death marks left by the limp rabbit that hung at my belt. Something large had struggled on the ground here, then been dragged away. A wide furrow ploughed through the leaves, disappearing into the darkness beyond. Heedless of my footing, I scrabbled my way down the side of the outcrop and rushed toward the furrow, following it under the overhanging low branches of hemlock and balsam. In the uncertain light of my flickering torch, I followed its path around a pile of rocks, through a clump of wintergreen, and... he was lying near the foot of a large split boulder, half covered in leaves, as though something had tried to bury him. He wasn't curled for warmth, but lay flat on his face and deathly still. The snow lay thick on the folds of his cloak, dusted the heels of his muddy boots. I dropped my torch and flung myself on his body with a cry of horror. He let out a blood-curdling groan and convulsed under me. I jerked back, torn between relief and terror. He wasn't dead, but he was hurt. Where? How badly? Where? I demanded, wrenching at his cloak, which was tangled round his body. Where are you hurt? Are you bleeding? Have you broken something? I couldn't see any large patches of blood, but I had dropped my torch, which had promptly extinguished itself in the wet leaves that covered him. The pink sky and falling snow shed a luminous glow over everything, but the light was much too dim to make out details. He was frighteningly cold. His flesh felt chilly even to my snow-numbed hands, and he stirred sluggishly, subsiding into small moans and grunts. I thought I heard him mumble, "Back," though, and once I got his cloak out of the way, I tore at his shirt, yanking it ruthlessly out of his breeks. This made him groan loudly, and I thrust my hands under the cloth in a panic, looking for the bullet hole. He must have been shot in the back. The entrance wound wouldn't bleed much, but where had it come out? Had the ball gone clean through? A small piece of my mind found leisure to wonder who'd shot him, and whether they were still nearby. Nothing. I found nothing. My groping hands encountered nothing but bare, clean flesh, cold as a slab of marble, and webbed with old scars, but completely unperforated. I tried again, forcing myself to slow down, feeling with mind as well as fingers, running my palm slowly over his back from nape to small. Nothing. Lower. There were dark smudges on the seat of his breeks. I'd thought them mud. I thrust a hand under him and groped for his laces, jerked them loose and yanked down his breeches. It was mud. His buttocks glowed before me, white, firm and perfect in their roundness, unmarred beneath a silver fuzz. I clutched a handful of his flesh, unbelieving.
"Is that you, Sassenach?" he asked, rather drowsily.
"Yes, it's me. What happened to you?" I demanded, frenzy giving way to indignation. "You said you'd been shot in the back."
"No, I didn't. I couldna, for I haven't been," he pointed out logically.
He sounded calm and still rather sleepy, his speech slightly slurred.
"There's a very cold wind whistling up my backside, Sassenach. Do you think you could maybe cover me?"
I jerked up his breeches, making him grunt again. "What the hell is the matter with you?" I said. He was waking up a bit. He twisted his head to look round at me, moving laboriously.
"Aye, well, no real matter. It's only that I canna move much."
I stared at him. "Why not? Have you twisted your foot? Broken your leg?"
No.
He sounded a trifle sheepish.
I've put my back out of joint."
"You what?"
"I've done it before,"
he assured me.
"It doesna last more than a day or two."
"I suppose it didn't occur to you that you wouldn't last more than a day or two, lying out here on the ground covered with snow."
"It did," he said,
still drowsy.
"But there didna seem much I could do about it."
It was rapidly dawning on me that there might not be that much I could do about it either. He outweighed me by a good 60 pounds. I couldn't carry him. I couldn't even drag him very far over slopes and rocks and gullies. It was too steep for a horse. I might possibly persuade one of the mules to come up here, if I could first find my way back to the cabin in the dark, and then find my way back up the mountain, also in the dark, and in the middle of what looked like becoming a blizzard. Or perhaps I could build a toboggan of tree branches, I thought wildly, and career down the snowy slopes astride his body. "Oh, do get a grip, Beecham," I said aloud. I wiped up my running nose with a fold of cloak, and tried to think what to do next. It was a sheltered spot, I realized. Looking upward, I could see the snowflakes whirling past the top of the big rock at whose foot we crouched. But there was no wind where we sat, and only a few heavy flakes floated down onto my upturned face. Jamie's hair and shoulders were lightly dusted with snow, and flakes were settling on the exposed backs of his legs. I pulled the hem of his cloak down, then brushed the snow away from his face. His cheek was nearly the same colour as the big wet flakes, and his flesh felt stiff when I touched it. Fresh alarm surged through me as I realized that he might be a lot closer to freezing already than I had thought. His eyes were half closed, and cold as it was, he didn't seem to be shivering much. That was bloody dangerous. With no movement, his muscles were generating no heat, and what warmth he had was leaching slowly from his body. His cloak was already heavy with damp. If I allowed his clothes to become soaked through, he might very well die of hypothermia right in front of me. "Wake up," I said, shaking him urgently by the shoulder. He opened his eyes and smiled drowsily at me. "Move," I said. "Jamie, you've got to move."
"I can't," he said calmly. "I told you that."
He shut his eyes again. I grabbed him by the ear and dug my fingernails into the tender lobe. He grunted and jerked his head away.
"Wake up," I said. "Do you hear me? Wake up this moment. Move, damn you. Give me your hand."
I didn't wait for him to comply, but dug under the cloak and seized his hand, which I chafed madly between my own. He opened his eyes again and frowned at me.
"I'm all right," he said, "but I'm guy tired, eh?"
"Move your arms," I ordered, flinging the hand at him. "Flat them, up and down. Can you move your legs at all?" He sighed wearily, as though dragging himself out of a sticky bog, and muttered something under his breath in Gaelic. But very slowly he began to move his arms back and forth. With more prodding, he succeeded in flexing his ankles, though any further movement caused instant spasms in his back, and with great reluctance began to waggle his feet. He looked rather like a frog trying to fly, but I wasn't in any mood to laugh. I didn't know whether he was actually in danger of freezing or not, but I wasn't taking any chances. By dint of constant exhortation, aided by judicious pokings, I kept him at this exercise until I had got him altogether awake and shivering. In a thoroughly bad temper, too, but I didn't mind that. "Keep moving," I advised him. I got up with some difficulty, having grown quite stiff from crouching over him so long. "Move, I say," I added sharply, as he showed symptoms of flagging. "Stop, and I'll step square on your back. I swear I will." I glanced around a little blearily. The snow was still falling, and it was difficult to see more than a few feet. We needed shelter, more than the rock alone could provide.
"Hemlock," he said, between his teeth.
I glanced down at him, and he jerked his head toward a clump of trees nearby.
"Take the hatchet. Big branches, 6 feet. Cut 4.
He was breathing heavily, and there was a tinge of colour visible in his face despite the dim light. He'd stopped moving in spite of my threats, but his teeth were clenched because they were chattering, a sign I rejoiced to see. I stooped and groped beneath his cloak again, this time searching for the hatchet belted round his waist. I couldn't resist sliding a hand under him, inside the neck of his fringed woolen hunting shirt.
Warm, thank God.
He was still warm. His chest felt superficially chilled from its contact with the wet ground, but it was still warmer than my fingers.
"Right," I said, taking my hand away and standing up with the hatchet. "Hemlock. 6-foot branches, do you mean?"
He nodded, shivering violently. And I set off at once for the trees he indicated. Inside the silent grove, the fragrance of hemlock and cedar enfolded me at once in a mist of resins and terpenes, the odour cold and sharp, clean and invigorating. Many of the trees were enormous, with the lower branches well above my head, but there were smaller ones scattered here and there. I saw at once the virtues of this particular tree. No snow fell under them. The fan-like boughs caught the falling snow like umbrellas. I hacked at the lower branches, torn between the need for haste and the very real fear of chopping off a few fingers by accident. My hands were numb and awkward with the cold. The wood was green and elastic, and it took forever to chop through the tough, springy fibres. At last, though, I had four good-sized branches, sporting multiple fans of dense needles. They looked soft and black against the new snow, like big fans of feathers. It was almost a surprise to touch them and feel the hard, cold prick of the needles. I dragged them back to the rock and found that Jamie had managed to scoop more leaves together. He was almost invisible, submerged in a huge drift of black and grey against the foot of the rock. Under his terse direction, I leaned the hemlock branches fan up against the face of the rock, the chopped butt ends stuck into the earth at an angle so as to form a small triangular refuge underneath. Then I took the hatchet again and chopped small pine and spruce branches, pulled up big clumps of dried grass, and piled it all against and over the hemlock screen. Then at last, panting with exertion, I crawled into the shelter beside him. I nestled down in the leaves between his body and the rock, wrapped my cloak around the both of us, put my arms around his body, and held on hard. Then I found the leisure to shake a bit. Not from cold, not yet, but from a mixture of relief and fear. He felt me shivering and reached awkwardly back to pat me in reassurance.
"It will be all right, Sassenach," he said. "With the two of us, it will be all right."
"I know," I said, and put my forehead against his shoulder blade. It was a long time before I stopped shaking, though. "How long have you been out here?" I asked finally. "On the ground, I mean." He started to shrug, then stopped abruptly, groaning.
"A good time. I was just past noon when I jumped off a wee crop of rock. It was no more than a few feet high, but when I landed on one foot, my back went click. And next I knew I was on my face in the dirt, feeling as though someone had stabbed me in the spine with a dirk."
It wasn't warm in our snug by any means. The damp from the leaves was seeping in, and the rock at my back seemed to radiate coldness, like some sort of reverse furnace. Still, it was noticeably less cold than it was outside. I began shivering again, for purely physical reasons. Jamie felt me and groped at his throat.
"Can you get my cloak unfastened, Sassenach? Put it over you."
It took some manoeuvring, and the cost of a few muffled oaths from Jamie as he tried to shift his weight, but I got it loose at last and spread it over the two of us. I reached down and laid a cautious hand on his back, gently rucking up his shirt to put my hand on cool, bare flesh. "Tell me where it hurts," I said. I hoped to hell he hadn't slipped a disc. Hideous thoughts of his being permanently crippled raced through my mind, along with pragmatic considerations of how I was to get him off the mountain, even if he wasn't. Would I have to leave him here and fetch food up to him daily until he recovered?
"Right there," he said, with a hiss of indrawn breath. "Aye, that's it. A wicked stab just there. And if I move, it runs straight down the back of my legs like a red-hot wire."
I felt very carefully, with both hands now, probing and pressing, urging him to try to lift one leg. "Right? Now the other knee. No?"
"No," he assured me. "Dinna be worried, though, Sassenach. It's the same as before. It gets better."
"Yes. You said it happened before. When was that?" He stirred briefly and settled, pressing back against my palms with a small groan.
"Oh, damn, that hurts. At the prison."
"Pain in the same place?"
"Aye."
I could feel a hard knot in the muscle on his right side, just below the kidney, and a bunching in the erector spinae, the long muscles near the spine. From his description of the prior occurrence, I was fairly sure it was only severe muscle spasm, for which the proper prescription was warmth, rest, and anti-inflammatory medication. Couldn't get much farther away from those conditions, I thought, with some grimness. I suppose I could try acupuncture, I said, thinking aloud. I've got Mr. Willoughby's needles in my pouch, and...
Sassenach, he said, in measured tones. I can stand fine being hurt, cold, and hungry. I will not put up with being stabbed in the back by my own wife. Can you not offer a bit of sympathy and comfort instead?
I laughed, and slid an arm around him, pressing close against his back. I let my hand slide down and rest in delicate suggestion well below his navel.
What sort of comfort did you have in mind?
He hastily grasped my hand to prevent further intrusions.
Not that, he said.
Might take your mind off the pain.
I wiggled my fingers invitingly, and he tightened his grip.
I dare see,
he said dryly.
Well, I'll tell you, Sassenach, once we've got home, and I've a warm bed to lie in, and a hot supper in my belly, that notion might have a good bit of appeal. As it is, the thought of... For Christ's sake, have you not the slightest idea of how cold your hands are, woman?
I laid my cheek against his back and laughed. I could feel the quiver of his own mirth, though he couldn't laugh aloud without hurting his back. At last we lay silent, listening to the whisper of falling snow. It was dark under the hemlock boughs, but my eyes were adapted enough to be able to see patches of the oddly glowing snowlight through the screen of needles overhead. Tiny flakes came through the open patches. I could see it in some places as a thin cloud of white mist, and I could feel the cold tingle as it struck my face. Jamie himself was no more than a humped dark shape in front of me, though as my eyes became accustomed to the murk, I could see the paler stalk where his neck emerged between his shirt and his queued hair. The queue itself lay cool and smooth against my face. By turning my head only a bit, I could brush it with my lips.
"What time do you think it is?" I asked. I had no idea myself.
I had left the house well after dark, and spent what seemed an eternity looking for him on the mountain.
"Late," he said. "It will be a long time before the dawn, though," he added, answering my real question. "It's just past the solstice, aye. It's one of the longest nights of the year." "Oh, lovely," I said in dismay. I wasn't warm, by any means. I still couldn't feel my toes, but I had stopped shivering.
A dreadful lethargy was stealing over me, my muscles yielding to fatigue and cold. I had visions of the two of us freezing peacefully together, curled up like hedgehogs in the leaves. They did say it was a comfortable death, but that didn't make the prospect any more appealing. Jamie's breathing was getting slower and deeper.
"Don't go to sleep," I said urgently, poking him in the armpit.
"Oh!"
He pressed his arm tight to his side, recoiling.
"Why not?
We mustn't sleep. We'll freeze to death."
"No, we won't," he said crossly. "It's snowing outside. We'll be covered over soon."
"I know that," I said, rather cross in my turn. "What's that got to do with it?"
He tried to turn his head to look at me, but couldn't quite.
"Snow's cold if you touch it," he explained, striving for patience. "But it keeps the cold out, aye? Like a blanket. It's a great deal warmer in a house that's covered with snow than one that's standing clean in the wind. How do you think bears manage? They sleep in the winter, and they dinna freeze."
"They have layers of fat," I protested. "I thought that kept them warm."
"Ha, ha," he said,
and reaching back with some effort, grabbed me firmly by the bottom.
"Well then, you needna worry a bit, eh?"
With great deliberation, I pulled down his collar, stretched my head up, and licked the back of his neck in a lingering swipe from nape to hairline.
"Ah!"
He shuddered violently, making a sprinkle of snow fall from the branches above us. He let go of my bottom to scrub at the back of his neck.
"That was a terrible thing to do," he said, reproachful, "and me lying here helpless as a log."
"Bah, humbug," I said.
I nestled closer, feeling somewhat reassured.
"You're sure we aren't going to freeze to death, then?"
"No," he said. but I shouldn't think it likely.
Hmm, I said, feeling somewhat less reassured. Well, perhaps we'd better stay awake for a bit then, just in case.
I will not weave my arms about any more, he said definitely. There's no room. And if ye stick your icy wee paws in my breeks, I swear I'll throttle you bad back or no.
All right, all right, I said. What if I tell you a story instead? Highlanders loved stories, and Jamie was no exception.
Oh, aye,
he said, sounding much happier.
What sort of story is it?
A Christmas story, I said, settling myself along the curve of his body. About a miser named Ebenezer Scrooge.
An Englishman, I dare say.
Yes, I said. Be quiet and listen. I could see my own breath as I talked, white in the dim, cold air. The snow was falling heavily outside our shelter. When I paused in the story, I could hear the whisper of flakes against the hemlock branches and the far-off whine of wind in the trees. I knew the story very well. It had been part of our Christmas ritual, Frank and Brianna's and mine. From the time Bree was 5 or 6, we had read A Christmas Carol every year, starting a week or two before Christmas, Frank and I taking it in turns to read to her each night before bed. And the spectre said, I am the ghost of Christmas past. I might not be freezing to death, but the cold had a strange hypnotic effect nonetheless. I had gone past the phase of acute discomfort, and felt now slightly disembodied. I knew my hands and feet were icy, and my body chilled half through, but it didn't seem to matter any more. I floated in a peaceful white mist, seeing the words swirl round my head like snowflakes as I spoke them. And there was dear old Fezziwig among the lights and music. I couldn't tell whether I was gradually thawing or becoming colder. I was conscious of an overall feeling of relaxation and an altogether peculiar sense of déjà vu, as though I had once before been entombed, insulated in snow, snug, despite desolation outside. As Bob Cratchit bought his meagre bird, I remembered. I went on talking automatically, the flow of my story coming from somewhere well below the level of consciousness. But my memory was in the front seat of a stalled 1956 Oldsmobile, its windscreen caked with snow. We had been on our way to visit an elderly relative of Frank's, somewhere in upstate New York. The snow came on hard halfway there, howling down across the icy roads with gusts of wind. Before we knew where we were, we had skidded off the road and halfway into a ditch, the windscreen wipers slashing futilely at the pelting snow. There was nothing to be done but wait for morning and rescue. We had had a picnic hamper and some old blankets. We brought Brianna up into the front seat between us, and huddled all together under coats and blankets, sipping lukewarm cocoa from the thermos, and making jokes to keep her from being frightened. As it grew later and colder, we huddled closer, and to distract Brianna, Frank began to tell her Dickens' story from memory, counting on me to supply the missing bits. Neither of us could have done it alone. But between us, we managed well. By the time the sinister ghost of Christmas yet to come had made his appearance, Brianna was snuggled sound asleep under the coats, a warm, boneless weight against my side. There was no need to finish the story, but we did, talking to each other below the words, hands touching below the layers of blankets. I remembered Frank's hands, warm and strong on mine, thumbs stroking my palm, outlining my fingers. Frank had always loved my hands. The car had filled with the mist of our breathing, and drops of water ran down inside the white-choked windows. Frank's head had been a dark cameo, dim against the white. He had leaned toward me at the last, nose and cheeks chilled, lips warm on mine as he whispered the last words of the story. God bless us, every one, I ended, and lay silent, a small needle of grief like an ice splinter through my heart.
It was quiet inside the shelter, and seemed darker. Snow had covered over all the openings. Jamie reached back and touched my leg.
"Put your hands inside my shirt, Sassenach," he said softly.
I slid one hand up under his shirt in